Ljubljana,
Bratislava,
Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest,
A very warm welcome to another edition of Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, Russia has a new president, but will Dmitry Medvedev make a difference? Or is Vladimir Putin calling the shots?
President Putin has been very clear on this point that he intends remaining this central and powerful role, and he definitely intends calling the shots. And in all the interviews that he has been giving and the speeches that he's made that point, and never once did he say, I'm going to play second fiddle. That just simply hasn't been mentioned.
Also on the programme, after 9 months of political deadlock, Belgium's new prime minister is ready to take office. We'll mark the 100th anniversary of Women's Day with a special performance in Sweden. We'll head to the moon for a historic trip to space. And what on earth is sight jogging? We take you on a special tour of Rome.
And what we're coming up to is a church called Santa Maria in Trastevere. Okay. We'll slow down a little bit because it's quite an interesting church.
All those stories and more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. I'm Barbara Gruber in Bonn, Germany. Russia is about to enter a new political era with last weekend's presidential election. Or is it? President Putin is stepping down after serving 2 terms in office, as dictated by the Russian constitution, and Dmitry Medvedev is taking over. Mr. Medvedev has been plucked from relative obscurity to continue the path taken by his mentor Vladimir Putin. However, Mr. Putin isn't planning on retiring anytime soon. It's expected that he'll stay on as prime minister, raising fundamental questions about who will really be in charge of Russia. Emma Simpson has more from Moscow.
Дорогие друзья, сегодня здесь с нами на Красной площади Владимир Путин и Дмитрий Медведев.
At a post-election celebration concert, President Putin emerged with his protege Dmitry Medvedev, standing shoulder to shoulder. Another carefully choreographed symbol of the transition of power.
Привет, Россия! Привет, Москва!
But here in the Russian capital, many people are now wondering who will be the more powerful figure once Mr. Medvedev takes office in 2 months' time. Chris Weefer, the chief strategist of Euroseb Bank, says Vladimir Putin isn't planning on disappearing anytime soon.
President Putin has been very clear on this point that he intends remaining this central and powerful role, and he definitely intends calling the shots. And in all the interviews that he has been giving and the speeches that he's made that point, and never once did he say, I'm going to play second fiddle. That just simply hasn't been mentioned.
Is that because Dmitry Medvedev is simply keeping the seat warm for Putin for a possible return, or is this President Putin protecting his protege?
Well, that's the big question, and frankly, we don't know the answer to that, because Russians, they love conspiracy theories, and there's an absolute multitude of conspiracies abounding in the city about this.
President Medvedev with a Prime Minister Putin. People are already talking about a two-headed leadership. But this is a country where sharing power traditionally hasn't worked. Masha Lipman, an analyst at the Carnegie Center, says Russia is entering uncharted political territory.
The person holding the topmost position of power, actually the position of the only decision-making center, is stepping down at the peak of his popularity and is not leaving the political scene. We've never had that before. How this is played, we don't know. With 2 centers of power, this should send confusing signals, not just to the West, but also, most importantly, within Russia.
Confusion over who's in charge can breed instability, something that Russia doesn't need, and the West certainly doesn't want to see either. There's plenty of speculation in the media here. Peter Lavelle is a political commentator for the TV channel Russia Today. He believes Dmitry Medvedev will be his own man in the Kremlin.
I think President Putin wants to see Mr. Medvedev succeed, but they're very different types of people. They're not clones of each other, which so many in media say. There are generation difference. There's a different mindset. Mr. Medvedev is from a bourgeois family. He's someone that was brought up with very different tastes. He doesn't have a whole real strong memory of the Soviet Union. And he is a liberal, he is supportive of civil society, he is supportive of democracy.
But Medvedev is no Russian John F. Kennedy. Don't expect anything too different, according to Masha Lipman.
It is tempting to think, based on Medvedev's rhetoric, that he's a softer guy, a more liberal guy than Putin is. However, this is mere rhetoric. Putin, too, many times sounded quite liberal, pledging to press freedom, saying that Russia should become a free country of free people. But even if he had core beliefs that were democratic, his ability to implement his beliefs and put them into reality is very strongly limited, to say the least.
In other words, Russia won't be his to lead, at least initially. How Dmitry Medvedev and Vladimir Putin share power will profoundly affect Russia's relationship with the outside world. The election may have been dull, but the next few years, it seems, could be anything but. Emma Simpson, Deutsche Welle Radio, in Moscow.
Now, from presidential elections to local elections, this weekend people in France are going to the polls to vote for their local governments, mayors, regional and local governing councils. Mayors and local governments are the first point of call for the problems and daily concerns of French citizens. But these elections are also seen as a referendum on the national government, and the results of the president's party will no doubt reflect what people think of him. Calais in the north of France is one of the last communist strongholds in the country. The opposition has put together an unconventional campaign to try to oust the mayor there. Radio France International's Sarah Elzis has this report from Calais.
Candidates for local office go door to door in the northern French city of Calais. You may have heard of Calais through stories of immigrants who end up here, hoping to cross into England. Calais is the closest French city to the UK on the banks of the English Channel. It's also an industrial town that's been hemorrhaging jobs as companies have moved their operations overseas. So it's no surprise that unemployment is the main issue for candidates running for mayor this week.
6,400 people on minimum wage, 14% unemployment, despite the potential in this city.
Philippe Blais is second on a list headed by Natasha Bouchard. She's trying to beat the incumbent mayor, a member of the Communist Party, which has been running the city for almost four decades. Bouchard is on the right, part of the UMP, President Nicolas Sarkozy's party, but she's brought together people from the center and the left, including Philippe Blais, who still considers himself a member of the Socialist Party.
Extraordinary situations call for extraordinary measures. It was a difficult decision to join this list. I have been with the Socialist Party since 1986, but I've gotten really good reactions. People understand that we're going beyond our labels to work for the people of Calais.
Blais is knocking on doors in a building in the Beaumarais, a typical public housing neighborhood a couple kilometers from downtown. The stairwells of this 14-story building are covered with graffiti. The elevators work intermittently. Poor people aren't being taken care of, says this woman. She worked in hotels in Paris, but she can't find a job here. She's 45 years old, a bit too old to get hired, she says, but not old enough to get retirement benefits. I should have stayed in the Paris area, she says. Blais elicits similar dissatisfaction from everyone he talks to. Almost a third of Calais' 73,000 people live in social housing. The city and the region have some of the highest unemployment rates in the country.
Bonjour, madame.
Supporters of the current mayor, Jacques Hénin, are going door to door in another neighborhood. These are two-story townhouses with front yards. Those who answer the doors tend to be elderly women. There's less discussion here, just cheerfully handing a leaflet and reminding people to vote. These candidates have less to prove. Mayor Hénin says their record backs them up.
People are looking what our team has done and our program for the future, which has to do with housing, social services, culture, sport, what makes up daily life.
Bref, ce qui fait la vie.
Hénin defends his record on jobs. He also says that mayors can only do so much to bring in companies.
If mayors could bring jobs to cities, there would be employment everywhere in the world. I can support companies, but I don't decide which ones come here. The mayor of Saint-Omer, which is nearby, who is on the right, he's just had 2,500 people laid off. Am I going to say the company left because he's on the right? No, it's nothing to do with him. It's just that in Europe, jobs are constantly being outsourced overseas.
The local elections tend to be decided over local issues. They're also political, a kind of referendum on the national government. It's likely that voters in Calais will re-elect a leftist government, continuing the Communist Party's rule for another 6 years. But the opposition may well tap into enough disenchantment that people will vote for a change. In any case, the first of two rounds of voting on Sunday may well determine the final outcome, as the smaller parties, the Greens, the far left, the far right, won't have a huge effect on the final results. For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Calais.
Nine months after general elections, Belgians finally look set for a new prime minister. The political stalemate, which was the longest in Belgian history, raised the prospect of a split between the French-speaking Walloons and the Dutch-speaking Flemings. Last week, Walloon and Flemish politicians finally broke the deadlock after agreeing on the first steps to reform the country. The deal paves the way for a new government to be formed by Easter, with Yves Le Terme, leader of the Flemish Christian Democrats, taking over from interim Prime Minister Guy Verhofstadt. But is the Belgian political crisis now really resolved? My colleague Vanessa Mock from Radio Netherlands put that question to the former Belgian Prime Minister, Mark Eyskens.
No, not yet, not totally, but I think the new government can be formed, headed by Mr. Le Terme, and then during that government one should negotiate a larger constitutional agreement. This country is in search of a new balance of power.
Walloons and the Flemings, they're going to have to now work together on some key reforms that will satisfy both sides, and yet actually the two sides now look further apart than ever.
I'm not sure if that is correct. You know, in the past we had also major conflicts between the two communities. Well, we solved them all. We have been now, since the elections of June the 10th, negotiating for 9 months. Well, the last 2 weeks, oh miracle, there was an agreement.
But the miracle wasn't forged by the group of politicians who brought about the deadlock. It's actually been forged by an older generation, older and wiser men and women.
The old generation has still more empathy for the politicians of the other linguistic group. And they know the art of confidence-building measures. Whereas the younger generation, they have been educated only in Dutch or only in French. For them, if they have to negotiate with people from the other community, it is like negotiating with another state.
But that's a problem, isn't it? Because this, the way that you set it out suggests that the language divide is now very, very wide indeed.
That's right, but there are also the constraints. And the major constraint is that separation is no alternative at all.
Why not?
Flanders on its own, 6 million people, economically wealthy, it could survive. But as a marginalized little state.
And yet there still is a lot of gnawing resentment, especially among the Flemish community, at what they perceive is the fact that they're propping up the poorer French-speaking part of Belgium. Can Belgium move away from this now?
Well, in every country there are transfers from the richer part to the poorer part. That's also the case in Italy. It's also the case in the United Kingdom. Except for the extremists, and they represent only 10 or 15% of the population in Flanders, but the vast majority is in favor of maintaining solidarity, but in clear terms.
In the past months, we've seen a lot of declarations that this was the beginning of the end for Belgium, that Belgium as a nation was starting to unravel. People saying that the very identity of Belgium had now been trampled underfoot. How deep do you think that the damage has been?
Seen from inside, the damage is, under control. But seen from outside, our reputation was hampered. I was a few months ago in Doha, Qatar, with the Emir So I was introduced to him and I said, oh, you're from Belgium. When is your country going to fall apart? So there was a general feeling that indeed these were the last days of my country. This is totally wrong. If we would organize a referendum after a campaign and explaining to people what the consequences would be of separation, I'm convinced that at least 85, perhaps 90% would vote in favor of maintaining the state of Belgium.
Former Belgian Prime Minister Mike Eyskens speaking there to Vanessa Mock from Radio Netherlands. Since 1908, International Women's Day on March 8th has been a day to recognize the achievements of women around the world, regardless of nationality, ethnic background, culture, economic status, or political beliefs. The idea of having an International Women's Day was first put forward at the turn of the 20th century. Rapid industrialization and economic expansion had led to protests over working conditions. 100 years ago, on March 8, 1908, 15,000 women marched through New York City demanding shorter work hours, better pay and voting rights. A century on, women around the world are still fighting for more rights. In Stockholm, Iranian, Iraqi, Swedish and other women, as well as supportive men, have now gathered to put forward their demands. Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller reports on a special appeal to mark the 100th anniversary of Women's Day.
Voices of Iranian immigrant women living in Sweden and performing on a Stockholm stage. A drama illustrating how young Iranian female university students in Tehran are harassed by uneducated, fanatically religious, moral watchdog women, accusing the students of possessing such dangerous weapons as mobile telephones or boyfriends, and plotting against the mullahs and the regime. A drama also including large photo screened on stage of defiant protesting university women beaten in public, faces bloodied, removed in police cars from the scene. Other measures of what's called sexual apartheid for women in some areas of the world, barriers to social life, to employment, to education. Interrogation on the streets and detention for improper clothing not fully covering the woman's head or hair. Violence and even murder of those women defying the man's world of strict regulations and rules for female family members.
My name is Mahin Alipur and I'm the responsible for the organization Equal Rights Now. And one little organization in Sweden that is called One Company for the Defense of Women's Rights. And we want to show the people today that there is one very radical and modern woman movement in Iran that fights sexual apartheid in Iran. And because of those 30 years that they have power in the Iran, we must do something. And we think that the governments here in Europa or other countries, they don't bother, you know. Often they meet the representative from the Iran and they do some kind of business or politic handle with them. And it's wrong because this regime is the responsible and is the representant for sexual apartheid in Iran.
A special declaration for Women's Day. What does the declaration say?
This declaration is a little special because of the 100th jubileum of the Women's Day. And this declaration do press the governments that accept the Iran's regime, sexual apartheid, and they must stop all politic business. And we want all the people sign that. Then we gather them and go to the United Nations or European Union and discuss those things also, and they must do something.
My name is Anki Elken and I'm an alternate in the Swedish Parliament for the Centre Party. I believe that it's very important that we show good examples and lead by example, that we don't trade in the extent that we do with those countries that are under dictatorship. And so I think that you can't condemn activities breaking human rights issues and in the other hand making business deals and taking pictures smiling with dictators.
Earlier, some women were a bit afraid of working together with immigrants and refugees.
Yes. And in the beginning, you know, when we wanted to speak about our rights or our problem in Middle East, they don't want to listen either. And they thought that it's our problem. But now they listen. And I think the solidarity is very, very good. And we have hope to gather such solidarity between the people.
Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller with this report on Women's Day. Thirty years ago, Vladimir Remek became the first man in space who was not from either the United States or the Soviet Union. After taking part in an eight-day Soviet space mission in March 1978, Remek became a hero, not only in his native Czechoslovakia, but right throughout the East Bloc. Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby spoke to the former cosmonaut about that historic flight and the propaganda that came with it.
My wish has come true. I'm a cosmonaut. I'd like to express my sincere thanks for this happy moment. With those words, Vladimir Remek addressed his compatriots in Czech from the Soviet spacecraft Soyuz 28, which began its mission on March 2, 1978. He was the first and so far only Czech in space.
The best or nicest thing about my mission was the teamwork. The crew were professional but also really enthusiastic. It was the first time somebody had flown in space who wasn't from a superpower. To this day, I'm glad about the work I did and that Czechoslovakia became the third country to have a man in space.
Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev and Czechoslovakia's Gustav Husák greeted the cosmonauts by radio during their mission. The latter replied, "Long live socialist internationalism." Today, Mr. Remek defends the propaganda aspect of the Soviet space program.
Space flights, especially the first cosmonauts and trips to the moon, were always the subject of a kind of political propaganda under both systems. But I can tell you that in the first few hours as we orbited the Earth, we were picking up reports on our receiver and we knew that people around the world were talking about us. Our spaceflight was used as propaganda, but all such propaganda has to be based on work successfully carried out, which our flight was.
Soyuz 28's 190-hour
mission took place a decade after Soviet tanks had rolled into Czechoslovakia to crush the Prague Spring. Some believe the Soviets selected a Czechoslovak cosmonaut in order to help soften anti-Russian feeling in the country.
I don't think so. If the Soviet leaders had any problems at that time, it wasn't a sense of guilt for entering Czechoslovakia. It could have been partly political, but what was really important was that we were among the strongest partners in the Intercosmos program, and our people were also on the UN Space Committee. And maybe we weren't the worst among those who prepared for the flight.
Vladimir Remek was a member of the pre-1989 Communist Party and has maintained those ideals. Now 59, he's a member of the European Parliament for the present-day Czech Communist Party.
Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby reporting there. Now, Rome wasn't built in a day, and seeing it in 24 hours is nearly impossible, unless you run. Well, lace up your sneakers and run, tourist, run. Guides from a company called Sight Jogging will provide you with a tour that's sprinkled with sweat and historical details. The tour's attracting fitness friends while baffling Romans who prefer a slower-paced life. Our reporter Nancy Greenlees went the extra mile to bring us this story.
I step into a hotel near St. Peter's Square and immediately recognize the running tour group. Tourists stand out in Rome because they're often fat and wearing white sneakers. These women have the mandatory foot gear, but legs like Michelangelo's David. Our guide is a lean Australian named Catherine Feehan.
Just to let you know that we need to be really careful on the cobblestones and on the stairs as well. Okay. Make sure you lift your feet when you run on the cobblestones because they often stick out at funny angles.
June Kennedy, who's here with her church choir, and I are soon following our guide's bouncing ponytail. We're weaving along the charming streets of the Trastevere neighborhood. The skies are cloudy and laundry flaps outside windows above us as we dodge tourists armed with gelato cones and señoras packing fresh bread. Fian takes us into an airy piazza.
And what we're coming up to is a church called Santa Maria in Trastevere. Okay. We'll slow down a little bit because it's quite an interesting church. So it was built in the year 499. Inside, the mosaics are beautiful. The roof is topped with like golden mosaics and artwork. It's really, really nice. So.
But we won't see the splendor in this church or a dozen others that we pass. Our shorts and sleeveless tops aren't exactly Pope-approved attire. Besides, we need to keep moving. Sight-jogging tours give a fleeting glimpse of a large swath of the city, with the idea that the tourists will return later to favorite sites. It's a love for Rome that prompted Carolina Gasparetto to found Sight Jogging. She was born in northern Italy and says she sees her adopted city like a foreigner, with constant wonder and awe. A few years ago, she was working as a personal trainer when she broached the idea of sight jogging to her brother and sister-in-law while seated in the back seat of their car.
The two of them turned around and asked, "Running?" That's the first image, the first impact of sight jogging.
Italians don't even run for the bus. They prefer a passeggiata, or a stroll, while tourists from the U.S., Great Britain, and Germany are filling sight jogging's tours. Meanwhile, we're attracting some attention from some befuddled Roman businessmen. From a distance, one yells, "Whoa!"
We haven't had too many comments today, actually. The other day we had some Italian guys waving their flags around and trying to start us and say, "Ready, set, go, basic."
Right now, my go is almost gone. Rome's built on seven hills, and we just went up one. Luckily, we're going back down. If we were hitting all seven hills, the story would end right about here. Yet adrenaline from the run and the unusual sights keeps me chugging along. As we approach our final stop, Fian encourages us to slow down.
Because it's not every day you get to run down to the entrance of St. Peter's.
Hello.
And awesome. Yeah, it's such a beautiful sight.
The sun is setting and gives the massive church a yellow glow. Tomorrow, Kennedy and her choir will sing here during the Pope's weekly address to the faithful. That will be a highlight of her tour, yet sight jogging also gets her blessing. She enjoyed seeing the local churches and hearing the quirky legends, all while exercising, something that she couldn't do with her choir.
We went to the Colosseum and stuff, and we went on a bus, so yeah. I just ran there and back. So.
Well, some people might say, "You're on vacation. Why are you running?"
They're not runners.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, a runner can't go on vacation and not run. Yeah. It doesn't feel right.
We ran about 10 kilometers in about an hour and a half and saw far more than the average tourist. Fian says sight jogging's clients get some added perks for sweating.
You get to learn lots of different things, so it's really, really fantastic. It's great. And then you go and enjoy your gelato afterwards. Yeah, so it's fantastic.
Sight jogging may soon assuage some guilt for the gluttonous who are visiting other Italian cities. Tours are in the works for Florence and Venice. In the floating city, runners will be guided along the narrow paths. No plans for sight swimming in the canals. Nancy Greenlees, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
And that's almost all we have time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here's our latest quiz. This month, we want you to identify a French film director, writer, and producer who's celebrating his birthday on March 18th. He was born in Paris to parents who were both scuba diving instructors, and this very much influenced his childhood. He long thought about becoming a marine biologist, but then discovered film. Over the coming 3 weeks, we'll give you a different clue as to his identity. Here's the first one. It's the opening scene from one of his earlier films.
Alors, bande de piquants, qu'est-ce que vous cherchez là?
à part des emmerdes. Goyade, c'est ton vieux, ça? Hein? Hein? Antoine.
Papa?
Antoine, c'est pas toi.
On est en manque.
Tu vas pas tirer sur ton petit ange, hein? Hein? Hein?
So if you know which film director we're looking for, email your answer to contact@networkeurope.org. If not, tune in next week for our second clue. Of course, you can always check out our webpage at networkeurope.org, where we'll post all of this month's clues. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I'm Barbara Gruber saying thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next week.